Yosemite Valley is quiet today. 2 weeks ago, the most popular place in the park closed to the public due to the Ferguson fire. Then last Friday, officials evacuated the remaining Yosemite residents and employees from the valley floor as the fire spread to all three roads leading into the valley. As of Tuesday morning, the fire has burned over 94,000 acres and is 43% contained. While the roads are quiet now, save for firefighting activity, on a typical August day, they're jam-packed with cars. In fact, Yosemite's massive popularity has resulted in summertime visits that more closely resemble being stuck on a freeway in L.A. than a visit to the wilderness. This congestion, or as some people call it, loving the park to death, is one of the subjects of a new podcast from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento called Yosemite Land. It's produced by former Valley Public Radio reporter Ezra David Romero. In a moment, we'll talk with Ezra about how the park is dealing with fires and climate change, but we begin our discussion with an excerpt from Episode 2 of Yosemite Land and learn why gridlock is one of Yosemite's most pressing issues.
When I arrived a few weeks ago at around 8 a.m., there was already a line of 15 cars waiting to go through the Highway 41 entrance into the park. A ranger walked up to my car.
Hello.
Do you already have an entrance pass?
Yeah, I have an annual pass.
So you get to go around both lanes on the far right.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too.
That felt like sheer luck. She let me go around everybody. Gridlock is more than a regular scene in Yosemite during the peak season. It's so bad that often people enter and never get out of their cars because they can't find parking. Kim Wiseman drives the shuttle and deals firsthand with traffic.
It's not something you think you would experience up here in the woods, but it's just randomly very much LA-style traffic here.
All this congestion taints the allure of Yosemite for me. It's less awe-inspiring knowing I have to wake up really early or wait in really long lines. The Park Service totally gets this. Yosemite Public Information Officer Scott Gedeman says they're actively working to improve things by adding to the approximately 2,000 parking spots here.
We can handle the 4.5, even 5 million visitors. It's the traffic, it's the congestion, it's the parking that are really not only impacting us for managing the park, but are ultimately impacting the visitor experience.
The park's done a number of things to ease traffic, including moving parking lots and building a traffic circle by the main store in Yosemite Village. The goal is to move cars away from nature. They also offer shuttle services, promote bus rides into the park, and are testing parking pilot projects. The vast amount of cars entering Yosemite daily aren't just bad for people searching for parking. It's harming wildlife.
You're talking about 10% of our bears potentially being hit by vehicles each year.
That's Yosemite wildlife biologist Ryan Leahy. In 2017, 23 bears were hit and 4 of them died. As of June, 3 bears have been hit by cars, but that was before the busy season. In response to all these bear car collisions, Ryan's team created a website where people can see where bears are often hit. They can also track GPS-collared bears, but their exact locations are altered. Ryan is showing me the real-time tracker, which I totally geeked out over.
This bear traveled like 30 miles here to go back to where it appears like it's gonna den.
Ryan hopes this site helps curb the number of bears killed or wounded. Even though technology has reduced the number of human encounters with bears, there's still just too many cars. And it might take an extreme change to remedy the problem. Tom Turrentine studies traffic and electric cars at UC Davis.
You could improve Yosemite a lot if you took cars out of it.
That's been done elsewhere during certain times of day and year in places like Zion National Park. There's also ideas of parking structures outside Yosemite or paying a premium to park closer, which could present problems with the Park Service's goal of providing access to people of all incomes.
There was even talks at one time for building parking underground. That was radical.
He's talking about in Yosemite Valley, and I'm sure that would never happen. But let's face it, until something drastic is done, we're just going to have to wait and wait if we visit the park in the summer. For Yosemite Land, I'm Ezra David Romero with Capital Public Radio News.
Here to continue the conversation we have with us on the phone right now, Ezra David Romero from Capital Public Radio and formerly with VPR. Ezra, welcome back to our air.
Hey, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today, and great work with this podcast, Yosemite Land. We heard one of the episodes here. You have a new episode, though, that just came out yesterday about fire in the park. Certainly very timely, given what is happening right now with the Ferguson fire. You're looking at this in a big picture perspective. You know, Yosemite has always been faced with wildfire as part of the natural environment, but how does it face this new problem today, especially with in light of climate change?
So national parks use fire in a different way than, say, national forests would. They do a lot of prescribed burns and things like that. They let lightning fires in the high country burn out into these rock formations, you know, to let Mother Nature sort of have her way. But I did speak with Kelly Martin. She's Yosemite National Park's fire chief, and she said she has this grand vision of looking at the landscape like a patchwork quilt and seeing all the previous areas where fires have burned and sort of mapping out where we should do prescribed or manual burns to sort of stop big fires in the future.
You mentioned the different techniques and approaches in dealing with wildfire in national parks versus national forests. Has Yosemite seen evidence of the results of that?
I would say the big difference is you're not seeing these large-scale fires in Yosemite National Park itself. You know, you're seeing them on the perimeter of the park, on the edges. And even with this fire, the park didn't close down in the beginning because the fire was in the park. It was a couple miles away. It closed down because of smoke, and they wanted to close roads so, like, bulldozers and other equipment that fire personnel are using could use these roads and not have tourists clog up these areas. And so even with the two fires last year, they were on the perimeter of the park. They were off of a Highway 41, the Empire Fire up there. And they grew to about 16,000 acres combined, these two fires. And so Kelly Martin was saying that was in part because they've done prescribed burns in a lot of Yosemite.
We're just storm chasers to these great big wildfires, which is almost $3 billion a year. And the prescribed fire program might only get a tenth of that money nationwide. And so if you really think about, if we were to shift some of that money from suppression and putting it into doing larger landscape treatments, you know, could we create those footprints in the future that will limit the large rim fire that hit Yosemite on the north end of the park?
So with this series, you're looking at a lot of different issues, not just wildfire. In your opening episode, you looked at a lot of different things. And it seems that there's this sort of tension between people who want to go to Yosemite to get away and yet at the same time want to have all the comforts of home. They want to have their cell phone service. They want to have their Starbucks and all these other amenities. What did you hear from people on that? Is that one of the central themes that you hear from people, that there's this tension between trying to get away and trying to have the comforts of home?
Yeah, I think you and I know, Joe, because we grew up in Fresno, the Fresno area, that people go there, and sometimes we go there and try to avoid Yosemite Valley because of how packed it is, right? I had this interesting moment where I was walking in the park and I had just got a Starbucks because I wanted a coffee, and people were staring at me and looking at me like, where did you get that coffee from? Like, does that exist here? Where is that Starbucks? And so I told them where it was and they went over there. And it was just this moment where, like, that whole commercialization thing came up. You know, it was like commercialization realized or something like that. You know, it's like it was just evident. And, you know, I just think it, like, put in perspective that balance or that, like, tension, right? Like, some people got so pissed off that Starbucks was opening or that, like, people can get on their cell phone and take tons of selfies near Yosemite Falls or Half Dome. But you know what? This is like a national park and it's a resource that everyone wants to come visit and see. And that's why people come from around the world every year to see this place. And so it's that tension of providing this resource but not over-commercializing it at the same time. And it's something hard to toggle because commercialization has been in the park for a long time, since its beginning. There's been hotels, there's been big corporations there. So the Starbucks thing, the cell phones are sort of just like the tip of the iceberg. It's like there's all this other stuff underneath it.
Did you feel a little strange getting that Starbucks at Yosemite?
The first time I did, you know, I've been to Yosemite, I don't know, 50 to 100 times, and I was used to, like, to the food that wasn't great in the park, and now the food tastes a little bit better. There's a Starbucks, and I felt weird at first, but then it sort of felt normal afterwards, you know? It didn't feel too weird because it didn't feel too weird because I already feel like I'm in a city when I'm there. I don't necessarily feel like I'm in the middle of nowhere when I'm in Yosemite Valley, just because there's so many people.
Now, of course, Yosemite is not just Yosemite Valley. In many cases, there's a fabulous wilderness throughout the park and places where you can go and not see anyone and not see another soul. You went to a few different places. In fact, doing climbing, you ran into some rather surprising fellow climbers. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so the third episode is all about rock climbing in the park and how rock climbing has changed Yosemite's identity in many ways. You know, rock climbers used to be these like kind of like dirtbag guys or bandits, and now they're, some of them can even be celebrities. There's this guy named Alex Honnold who climbed up Half Dome. He's also climbed up El Capitan with no ropes or no cams or devices to clip him in. And so I ran into him on the trail, talked to him, I ended up interviewing him, and he's just this like 32-year-old guy who's just kind of cool and just kind of down to earth, but he's doing these extreme things. And so that's what this episode is all about. It's about how guys like him are pushing the sport forward and sort of putting it into the mainstream and making rock climbing really cool. And we also talked to a bunch of local young climbers who climb in rock climbing gyms, and we talk about how rock climbing gyms have changed the culture of who climbs in Yosemite. It's diversified it.
There are a lot of these little subcultures, aren't there, in different parts of the park or different activities. Is that something that you see?
Yeah, you know, there's hikers, there's climbers, the people who like to just come in and like rent a pop-up tent that's already there, right? And then there's other associations and people all across the park. It's just this like land of many uses. It's this place where people want to come and experience it. Like everyone coming in is a tourist unless you're part of the Park Service or you work there. So it's just that people want different things out of their experience. And I think in Yosemite, they can get it. The park is big enough. You just might have to hike a little bit to get there.
So where else are you going with this podcast? Give us a little sneak preview, if you can, of what's going to be on tap in future episodes.
This week's episode is all about fire and the future of fire in the park. And then in the weeks to come, we're going to talk about how other ways climate change is affecting the park, everything from amphibians to animals. We're also going to talk to a bunch of Native American people who have ties to Yosemite Valley and what they want the park to look like. And we talk about the new village that's being built there. We'll also talk about Hetch Hetchy and this age-old battle that's sort of over this place. Hetch Hetchy is this big reservoir in the park that provides water to the Bay Area. And there's a group that wants it to be gone, and they want it to restore it to make it look like Yosemite Valley. They call it like Yosemite's little brother or little cousin or something like that. We'll also talk about the renaming of places in the park. And then the end episode, we might be doing a live episode from Yosemite where we do like a panel discussion and we talk about some of the issues we've talked about this whole time, but live in Yosemite, and we'll air that as is.
Sounds fantastic. We'll be looking forward to all of that again. Ezra David Romero of Capital Public Radio, host and producer of the new podcast series Yosemite Land, joining us on Valley Public Radio today. You can find it on the iTunes podcast store and also on the NPR One app, Yosemite Land. Again, Ezra, thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations to you doing great work up north of us.
Thanks, Joe.